So the first part of this talk is kind of to give you an overview of what Buddhist ethics is and how we might think about where does this idea of right livelihood or Buddhist way of doing business comes into it, fit into Buddhist path. And then the second part is actually we are going to look at one of my research, fieldwork research in Myanmar. I think it was over 10 years ago. So the talk is divided into two parts. So can we go to the next slide, please?
Yes, this one, right?
I'm not sure to what extent you have studied Buddhism and Buddhist path as a way. But if we look at early Buddhism, so kind of Pali canon Buddhism in southern or Theravada Buddhism, what we find is that in terms of Buddhist path, this is one of the way to think about Buddhist path as in how to reach to the Buddhist goal of soteriological goal, i.e. Nirvana. And this is one representation of how the Buddhist path can be think about. So you can see here, there are 8 factors, and this is the technical term is Noble Eightfold Path, because there are 8 factors in this path, and the 8 factors, they work very much in harmonious way, meaning that these eight factors have to come together in order to achieve liberation, Buddhist liberation. And you can see here the first part way to kind of is the morality. So we might think of morality as in kind of a foundation level. And for that, right speech, number 3, right action, and right livelihood. Right livelihood, a very crucial component Buddhist path. And then a way to categorize these 8 factors is in a form of concentration or mental capacity. We try to develop our mind, and through right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Sometimes you might see right concentration as well. So, different ways to translate these terms. And through that, the main aim is to develop our mind. First to calm it down, so right or right concentration, and then go into insight meditation, as in kind of being mindful of the present moment as well as other mental factors. And of course, right effort is kind of encouraging us to bring these different elements together. And then the factors number 1 and 2, it's wisdom, as in trying to understand right thought or right intention. So these 8 factors, they have to work together. In this talk, what I want to focus on is right livelihood. So how do in Myanmar or even in general, how do they kind of practice aspect of Buddhist path? Next slide, please. So like I said, Noble Eightfold Path, technical that is sila, as we saw, of Buddhist morality, is a very central part of these 8. And think about Buddhist morality, at least in early Buddhism, we can think of in terms of two aspects. So the first part is to from doing negative things, so such refraining from stealing or killing, you know, those kind of but you know, also doing doing positive actions such as donation monks and nuns or other kind of charity work or meditation, these kind of action that we do. So when we think about Buddhist morality, those two, they are very helpful in, okay, you just not, you have to do good as well as abstain other things. Why is it important? Because it's ties in very much in the concept of karma, one of the Buddhist doctrines. And here we think of karma as individualistic karma. What do I mean by that? It means, at a very basic kind of understanding, is, you know, all the intentional actions that we do, and we will get karmic effects from, you know, doing good things. We will get good effects. If we do bad things, we will get bad results. So, kind of very much individualistic karma. In Buddhist teachings, what we also find is kind of what we call socio karma or group karma, where our actions actually affects others and the environment. This concept become quite important when we think about Buddhist economics, as we will see later. And also another element to think about is spiritual development or mental development, especially Buddhist morality foundation, like I said, and in order to progress to you know, other along the path. So those ideas are quite much important. Next slide. Right. So, like, you know, I mentioned that the first aspect of morality is to abstain from bad things, and there are basic five, what we call five precepts, which you should you know, observe, and the formula, precept formula. It goes, I undertake the training rule to abstain from taking life and abstain from taking what is not. So this is not to steal, to abstain from sexual, to abstain from thoughts. This is not to lie, and to abstain from taking fermented drink was causes loss of awareness. So these five precepts, all lay Buddhists should try to observe, and they do observe these five precepts or not Buddhists at a later stage. But what it is that, you know, you can false speech. False speech. I ask, okay, how deal with what lie that you might you tell during our businesses or when we go about our daily life, as it were, and that was very important in my research as well, because I looked at or people, my respondents talk about that. So you can see we will explore these aspects later. Can we go to the please? The next one is let's focus a little bit more on how Buddhahood is defined. It's in the Pali Canon, we can kind of define it of, you know, right livelihood is, you know, our means of livelihood should be, should not be dishonest or otherwise cause suffering to other living beings. So this is kind of very basic and very generalized way of defining right livelihood. But there's also kind of avoiding wrong livelihoods. So another way of defining what livelihood is to avoid certain professions and certain things. So what are they? They are trade in arms, so weaponry, trading in living beings, including human trafficking, trading in meat, alcohol, and drugs, as well as poisons. So those are kind of, you know, listed in the Buddhist texts, saying that these are the wrong livelihoods. So what does that mean? It means that, you know, if we look at Buddhist countries, some such as Sri Lanka or Thailand, then we might find that butchers, they are not Buddhists. So Muslims and you know, other communities, they might be the one who taking on these roles. Of course, you know, when we visit Thailand or Sri Lanka or Burma, we see that, you know, they sell alcohol and it's drugs and everything is very pervasive. So you know, then obviously there's a moral dilemma, because here in the text we see that these are the wrong livelihood and you shouldn't do these professions and trade in these kind of things. But we do find it on the ground, as it were. Another kind of profession to think about is military and army. So how, you know, where would this kind of profession fall in? According to Damien Keons, who worked on Buddhist ethics in quite a lot of detail, looking at various kind of bioethics as well as other kind of ethics aspects, he focused on this kind of argument where, you know, if you, the idea is that if a soldier being killed in better on better grounds, where would he, you know, where would he be, he or she be reborn in the next life, and that kind of idea. So normally this in the text, what we find is that soldiers, if they were killed during the battle, they will be reborn in hell. So meaning that hell is one of the kind of unfortunate realm, what we call unfortunate realms. So not a very favorable rebirth. And the soldier, you know, being a soldier, you are, according to the text, you are likely to be reborn in hell. Why? Because it's at the death of, you know, at the moment of death, the soldier who is motivated to kill another another person, because of that kind of intention. So here karma is also important. The karma comes into play, and therefore that mental state will lead to rebirth in hell. So this kind of idea that, okay, if you are a soldier, the rebirth will not be good. However, according to, you know, Damien Keon's analysis is that, well, you know, through, when we look at the Buddhist time, the states, you know, different republican states in India and so forth, they had armies and, you know, various armies, generals visiting the Buddha, head of state visiting the Buddha, and they all had their own armies. And Keon's kind of argument is that, you know, the Buddha really didn't kind of prohibit having army or that kind of profession. because it, somehow you need that kind of army or, you know, any kind of weaponry as a deterrent for the state. So that kind of analysis, if you are interested in that kind of area, you can look at Keon's work. And then another kind of positive, performing positive actions also comes into kind of in relation to right livelihood, because we will see later that, you know, the idea of doing religious and social giving is part of that kind of right livelihood, and especially if we think about Buddhist or if we think about businesses these days, taking care of your stakeholders. Stakeholder here means kind of different groups of people who have an interest in a business or who is affected by a business. And so taking care of these stakeholders is very important. And we can also see that in the sutta, the next, the discourse that we're going to look at next. So can we go to next slide, please? So here, this is from one of the suttas, one of the discourses from the Pali Canon. And here, a Brahmin, a young Brahmin who is called Sigala, he got this kind of a set of advice from the Buddha, because Sigala, he was kind of a Brahmin. He was doing his own ritual, kind of washing the hair and worshipping different six different directions. And then he met the Buddha. The Buddha then kind of saying, ask Sigala, what are you doing? And Sigala explained that, okay, I've been taught to do these kind of worship. But here, the point is that the Buddha then say, well, that's not how you worship the six direction. If you want to worship the six directions, you need to take care of these different groups. And then the Buddha kind of rationalize or the ritual in a sense of explaining the parents, the relationship between parents and children, the teacher and students, wife and husband, and then friends represented by the north, employers, employees, and then religious practitioners. So how does one in the middle kind of relate to different groups of people? And there are a set of duties that one should perform. So these are the kind of, you know, here the Buddha is kind of rationalizing Brahminical ritual to an extent, and kind of, okay, you have to look after these different groups. What is relevant to our discussion here is how the relationship between employers and employees, for example. So you can see here the list of duties or commitments. The employees, they should rise before him. I mean, we have to think of these commitments or duties in the context of the Buddha's time. Basically, if we then kind of interpret it in modern life, we can make some sense out of these duties, as it were. So let's look at employees' commitment. So they arise before him, they go to sleep after him, they take only what is given. So this is not to steal, as it were. And they perform their duties well. So this is kind of responsibility, work-related responsibility duties, and they uphold their his good name and fame. So this is about kind of, if we think of it in terms of modern time, we might think of it in terms of branding. So you know, our employees' responsibility to advertise and have a good image and so forth. Employers' commitments, again, assigning them work according to their ability, so employees' ability. This means that they are, it's about kind of work allocation. So you know, matching capabilities with the work, as it were, by supporting them with food and wages. So here again, we see similar kind of ideas in modern business practices, in the sense of you know, benefits and bonuses and various other things, attending them in sickness. Again, some businesses offer kind of healthcare packages and things like that, and then granting them leave at times. So this is about holiday, you know, work holiday as it were. These are really kind of interesting in a sense that, okay, these are the kind of duties or commitments, whether, you know, in daily practice, in Buddhist countries, whether they follow these kind of things or not is another thing. But I should say that at least in Theravada countries, in Southeast Asia, for example, this sutta, this discourse is very famous, and children, you know, from a young age, primary school, they are taught these kind of duties. So how to behave towards their children, the teacher, how to behave towards parents and so forth. So it is quite accurate to say that this is kind of very within Buddhist culture, as it were, across different countries. Okay, the next slide, please. Again, in this discourse, the Buddha also gave financial advice, in the sense of, for, you know, personal financial management. So it says that 25% of our income should be spent on ease and convenience, so our daily expenditure as well. And then 50% should be reinvestment, meaning that, you know, you might want to spend in education or in training and so forth. Or and then 25% is for saving. So these, you know, if we look at the chart, it's kind of very prudent way of spending your own finance. That kind of financial management system can also be, I think, can also be applied to public finance. For example, you know, how the government spend for, you know, daily kind of thing, and social care and things like that. And then 50% for investment and in infrastructure, training, education, and things like that. And then for reserve, so any kind of economic shocks and things that, you know, we cannot predict. So, most of, as far as I know, most governments, they don't spend 50% of their income on investment, in infrastructure and things like that, partly because they can't afford that much in reality. For individual person, we might be able to, but you know, it's but the whole kind of point about this financial management system, as it were, is to take a very prudent approach to managing your finance. If we look at this discourse. That becomes very much important if we look at six ways of wasting wealth, which is again also appears in this discourse as well, where, you know, using intoxicant or wandering the street at inappropriate times. So wandering, you know, going out at nights and things like that, or going to public show, meaning concerts, whatever, you know, theater and so forth. And then compulsive gambling and associating with bad friends, or habitual laziness. So these kind of, according to this suttas, this discourse, there are six ways of wasting wealth. I think you might have some question about these things, you know, during Q&A time. We can explore these later if you have any questions about that. But what I would say, though, is if we think about, you know, number two, wandering the street at inappropriate times, so going out late at night, why would the Buddha kind of say something like that? Well, it's about kind of, you know, being aware of the danger of being mugged or robbed, you know, that kind of thing. And compulsive behavior of going to public shows and gambling, this is kind of one of the qualities promoted in Buddhism, is contentment or simple living. And so these kind of behavior, they are probably seen as a necessary indulgence for lay people. So it's that kind of reasoning behind it. And then let's look at about poverty. So shall we go to next slide? So poverty and moral decline. Here, this is again from another discourse where it's like a utopian, well, it describes a utopian state where the ruler, the king, was kind of ruling righteously, ruling the country righteously, but because of negligence, or he then kind of forgets the ruler's code of conduct, that led to poor governance. So then the government system kind of falling apart, as it were. That led to kind of poverty, because the king's not looking after his citizen very well. Poverty then led to death. So it's like people stealing and so forth. Death also kind of led to another side effect is capital punishment, because the king then start to kind of bring in capital punishment. But the king also kind of tried to implement financial support for any, you know, who are poor. But the system doesn't work. The welfare system doesn't work, because some people start to abuse the welfare system. And that also led to capital punishment, which meant, you know, they're breaking one of the precepts, which is abstaining from killing, so not to kill. And you can see here, it's like the cause of, the main cause of the whole moral decline is forgetfulness, you know, you're not remembering or being negligent of the ruler's code of conduct. But also it means that the poverty also is very bad for the society, as it were, because it also can lead to capital punishment and breaking the precept and the Buddhist precepts. So you can see here in this discourse how very much kind of our behavior is linked to moral decline and the society on the whole, how it affects the society on the whole. In other sutta, we also find where poverty can lead to kind of rebellion, as well as kind of, you know, any kind of unrest in the country. So those kind of things we can also find in discourses. So I think, you know, this is in this part we cover a foundation for, you know, different how different Buddhist concepts kind of come in together and link with building a healthy economy, financial management system, and things like that. Let's look at the next slides, please. Let's look at what we call Buddhist economics, which is a term coined by Schumacher. He was a kind of German British economics who he worked in different kind of senior role in different banks and everything, but also he was in Burma in 1950s, and that's where he got his influence from, and having visited Burma in the 50s. Right after, you know, the independence, he was very much influenced by the Buddhist teachings, as well as at that time, what happened was in Burma, they promoted a lot of Buddhist teachings, as well as the Sixth Buddhist Council. So there was a lot of state-sponsored Buddhist events. So that was what he was exposed to. So he brought in quite a lot of Buddhist ideas into economics, and then he coined this term. But he was also kind of very much interested in other kind of humanistic approach to economics. So how companies and businesses should do, they should run their business activities and so forth. So he also had some similar ideas, but then again he borrowed quite heavily on Buddhist concepts, and then he wrote this Small is Beautiful, which is one of the kind of seminal book if we talk about Buddhist economics. The main idea there is that he was arguing for maximum well-being with minimum consumption, which in this day and age, it sounds very much, I think it resonates quite well with environmental issues and global kind of climate change issues. But as with any other kind of economics theories and things like that, this economics theory didn't really kind of took off because he was kind of he was also competing with other theories as well. But another interesting thing that he encouraged was this idea of sufficient economy with localized and small scale production. But he was also kind of going against the stream, as it were, because around that time in the 60s, 70s and so forth, global economy was kind of taking hold, and kind of expansion was the main idea. That also didn't kind of, he had very little, his idea had very little impact on that. The another issue is that self-sufficient economy, is it really a right livelihood model? Because, you know, what about kind of monopolistic behavior? Meaning that, you know, even a small company in a local region, it can have a negative impact on consumer and things like that. the idea that in my article, I also kind of highlighted this point where, you know, being small isn't really kind of necessarily the right livelihood or a Buddhist model, because it can also have a negative impact on various other things. So if we think about Buddhist economics as such, the main idea, I think, is thinking about how different, how, you know, one business could impact a wider community rather than just kind of taking one aspect as a way. So shall we go to the next slide, please? Right, so having kind of looked into these different elements, you know, the first Buddhist concepts, different Buddhist concepts on right livelihood and economics, and then kind of looking at Schumacher's idea of Buddhist economics, I then did a research in Burma, and I kind of use anthropological approach, meaning that observation and participation, or rather participant observation, where I was participating in different activities, as well as doing surveys and interview for my, I think this was for my MA dissertation. By that time, you know, the literature was kind of very much focused on prescriptive ethics, so what Buddhist ethic, Buddhist economics should be. So you know, they were looking at the Noble Eightfold Path, or, you know, the Buddhist path, and looking at what the kind of prescriptive ethic is. But my focus for this research was descriptive ethics. I was very much interested in how people as in Buddhists in Burma actually behave, you know, when they do their business. And then I was also kind of including inclusiveness, meaning that it's kind of, I was in my kind of 45 respondents, I had people who are in gambling business or who are in entertainment business. Entertainment business is quite interesting. I will explain that later. But I also had a set of assumptions that I was kind of working from. So looking at Buddhism is not is social. So Buddhism is very much part of society. Buddhism interplays a lot with political situation, and also it's not anti-economical, because when we think about Buddhism in a sense of just kind of idealistic way, we might say that, okay, we should all be monks and nuns and go off to forest and meditate. But actually, you know, Buddhism has a lot of, as we saw, economical or ideas to do with economy. And also there are kind of socio-cultural constraints. What I mean here is that whenever people, my respondent explained to me, they were and they are kind of operating within certain cultural constraints. So they wouldn't go beyond that. That becomes quite interesting when we look at entertainment business, you know, industry, that really shows the cultural constraint. Another kind of idea here is that, you know, when we think about suffering or imperfections in the world, what I call imperfections, you know, there are three, at least three on each side. three negative mental tendencies, so greed, hatred, and delusion. And then they also have positive mental tendency, non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. So these are kind of the idea that very basic Buddhist doctrines, they come to influence us. And we will see that when we look at gambling, for example, people who operate within gambling industry. Let's move to the next slide. So one of my main focus of my research was this medium-sized trading business. It's traded, or it is trading in beans and rice and things like that, pulses. They don't do any export things. So they just within niche in Burma. And it's very kind of medium-sized family business. It employs around 100 people, so it's a medium-sized business. And the thing is that and the founder he was Chinese. He was kind of Chinese descendant. I'm not sure how much you're aware of ethnic groups within Myanmar, but we do have quite a lot of Chinese diaspora community in Burma. And the next slides, please. So when I kind of interview him about his kind of Buddhist, his kind of business ethics and the kind of motivation and things like that, I came to know that he kind of gave this house to one of his manager, and not just this house, but also for other managers and employees as well. So basically, he was kind of providing housing and things like that for employees, and you know, if we think about Burma, in a way, is very poor country. It's a poor country, and if someone kind of gave this kind of asset, give away this kind of asset, it's quite significant. It's also interesting because the managers, they've been working with this founder for many, many years. Some of them being working with him for about 40 years or something like that. So that's quite significant kind of family business. Another element is next slide, please. Another element is the kind of donation that he does. So he's part of this very big communities where they kind of offer food to 1,000 monks. 1,000 monks because in this town, it's quite well known for teaching monasteries. What I mean by teaching monasteries is that monks, a lot of monks, they go to this town to get education. And there are big kind of monasteries housing, some of them housing 300 monks or something like that. So it's quite a significant number of monks in this town. And what they do is they offer food, especially breakfast, for monks. And the monks, sometimes 1,000 or more, they come to the house to get the alms. So it's like they walk and get the food, and then they go back to their monastery. So that's daily routine, actually, not just for, and it happens throughout the year, not just for a certain period of time, but throughout the year, that's how they organize it. So you can see here a lot of employees actually contributing a lot for this kind of community or offering. Next slide, please. Here, this is actual kind of offering to the monks and the people, the employees, as well as the organizers. They come and do the offering. Next slide, please. Next slide. Yeah. Here, and then what they do is the monks, they come to the house and then they get the food, and then they share the merit. Marriage is I'm not sure. This is one of the key Buddhist ideas as well, where if we do good karma, we get what we call punya or merits from these kind of good actions. Especially in relation to donations, the belief is that we get a lot of good karma, good merit by offering food to the Sangha. And the donors, now they share the merit, not just with everyone, but also all beings in Buddhist cosmos. Spiro, who worked on Burmese Buddhism, he analyzed this kind of meritorious actions in terms of, his analysis is that Buddhists do these kind of meritorious action as a saving or as an investment. So his analysis of karma is very much kind of give and take kind of paradigm, where we invest in good actions and to get better rebirth in the next life. So that kind of idea. Of course, we find this kind of idea in Buddhist texts as well. In that sense, Spiro's analysis is not wrong. But my informants, sometimes they say that, well, they just do these kind of meritorious acts because that's part of who they are. They just do it. They don't think about, if I donate now, I will get a better rebirth. They don't think about it like that. The next slide is we get to, can you be a good Buddhist and a good business person? Here, a good business, so 12% of my informants said it's not possible to be both a good Buddhist and a good business person. Why? Because doing business involves some degree of selfishness. So for them, being selfishly kind of selling beans or rice or whatever, at a significant profit rate, that's being selfish, and therefore they say that, I'm not a good Buddhist because I'm trying to get things for myself and my family. Sometimes they say that it's very difficult to abstain from false speech, lying, so therefore they are not a good Buddhist. So here what I found was their definition of good Buddhist is interesting, because it's like they have a very high standard of measuring defining what a good Buddhist is. They say that it someone who has realized the Dharma, so attained some level of salvation or soteriological goals. So it's a very high level of standard in a way. Of course, a good Buddhist, a good business person means for them is being able to generate profit and take care of their family as well as other kind of employees and so forth. So This is, this is my finding. 12% is you might say that it's quite a low one, because if we go to the next slide, we will see how different people try to rationalize their behavior in a way. So, for example, I mentioned a person in a gambling business. So he still is a broker of Thai lottery. Thai lottery is very popular in Burma. It's not legal there, but still very popular. And he's been in the business for over 30 years, but at that time it's 20 years. But he still records his work as wrong livelihood because he's actually in gambling business. He shouldn't be. And then he says that it's performed many positive actions such as religious and social giving. He's very much active within his community, trying to kind of organize blood donations and various things as his charity work. And then he goes to meditation retreats and things. So here in this case, it's quite interesting because we see this idea of positive actions, or as a compensatory activities. So he tried to compensate his wrong livelihood by doing good things. To what extent can you kind of balance out? He's not sure as well when I asked that question, but this idea that you can compensate your kind of bad action by doing positive actions. Okay, I mentioned in entertainer, in Burma, within Burmese community, they say that if you are an entertainer, whether an actor or a singer, it's likely that these entertainers, they will go to hell because they are because of their livelihood. Why? Because the logic is that the entertainers, they are kind of actively promoting mental defilements in other people. So they are kind of the source of craving, for example, craving, which is one of the cause of birth and death and so forth in other people, and therefore their profession is regarded as wrong livelihood. So it's very interesting how entertainers and perhaps soldiers, they are kind of grouped together to a certain extent, but different motivation, different ways of thinking about it. Of course, when I interview one of the entertainers there, she said that, well, it's it is very important that her intention, why she does what she does is very important. She doesn't, for her, she doesn't go out to kind of increase craving in other people. She just want to entertain. She just want to make people laugh and people relax. So that kind of narratives also come through that. Next slide, please. Right. So how to kind of the Burmese concepts of how to succeed in business and in life. They often talk about karma, of course. So depending on your past karma from the past life, And then they also talk about your own knowledge and how much effort that you can you import that you put in. So this kind of idea of you know, you should increase your strength and then decrease your weakness, for example. That kind of idea is there. Another idea is getting help from other beings or powerful beings. This is Nikki Tenabon, Nicola Tenabon, her work on one of the ethnic groups in Thailand and in Burma, also relates to power relations between different groups or different beings. Of course, the Buddha being the most powerful being in the conception in the belief system, and then gods, Buddhist gods also comes in. Also, another powerful friends. You know, whether you have, you know, whether you have connections, you know, in the government or wherever. So these kind of getting help from powerful beings, very much embedded within business practices. What do I mean by that? Next slide, please. We can see that because when I interview one of the business person who I think at that time was doing kind of furniture. Yes, he was in the furniture business. And I visited his house, and this is his shrine room. And in his house, he had this Buddha images, these two Buddha images. You can see here, the Buddha image is holding a golden pot and then kind of having this kind of bringing luck, kind of the right hand is kind of like that. And so that mudra or that hand gesture kind of indicate that it's kind of bringing luck to the business and bringing to his family. Not only that, he offers kind of flowers and this kind of chant mantra and everything, part of his resolution or part of his daily ritual. And he's been doing that for 10 years. He attribute his good business to this kind of ritual, ritualistic practices, you know. And, you know, he says that he said that it's because of he's been doing these kind of things, he got really good business. Next slide, please. This photo shows how kind of, you know, this is a manager from the business that I study, you know, the one that that's trading in rice and beans. He's one of the managers there, and he always offer flowers and incense sticks and everything to a tree spirit, which is located in front of the business, and he asks for protection from any dangers. As well as acquisition as in kind of bringing more business, luck and everything. So you can see here, that's where, you know, rely on powerful beings. You might say that, okay, why a tree spirit might be more powerful than a human? Well, the belief there is that different gods or different spirits, they have different types of powers, and so it's relying on those or drawing on those different powers that you know Buddhists kind of rely on. So just to kind of conclude, next slide, please. Right. So you know, when we look at Buddhist texts and doctrines, we can see prescriptive ethics in a sense of very much, you know, ideal state where one would be observing the precepts, you know, and the right livelihood is part of the Buddhist path, taking care of stakeholders, as well as kind of the link between poor governance with moral decline. So those kind of prescriptive kind of ethics. But in descriptive ethics, when I kind of did the research, we also see very similar kind of ideas, caring for stakeholders and compensatory role of positive actions, as we saw with gambling, the person in the gambling industry, and then different power relationships. So the final point that I want to highlight here is, to me, the Buddhists in Burma, based on my research, they seem to have this kind of moral bricolage, meaning that they try to bring different elements or different aspects of their life to make sense of the ongoing ethical tension that they face in their right livelihood or their livelihood, their profession. You know, ideally, you know, my informants, my respondents, they say that we should keep all the precepts all the time. But, you know, they also acknowledge that that cannot be done. And therefore, they will try to make sense of these kind of different moral dilemmas in different ways. So that's all I want to say. But I next slide, let's look at bibliography. If you are interested in, say, like I said, so I publish some of my findings in this, in the Myths of Imperfections. And then Damien Keown's work is also very interesting. Another one is Spiro's work on economic actions in Burma. Again, also very interesting to look at. And if you are really interested in the kind of you know, how power relationships and Buddhists think about relationship with different beings in Buddhist cosmos, Nicola Denabem's work is really, really interesting one, because you know, she highlighted different ways of looking at the worldview of one of the Dai groups in Southeast Asia. This is Shan is one of the biggest ethnic groups in Southeast Asia. So that's and so. I think, yes, that's all I want to highlight.